You want to know what terrible technology is headed your way in the years ahead? Journalist and science fiction author Cory Doctorow says it's not hard.
If you want to know a little about your future, at least technologically, look at the terrible technology we're making kids use. And if you want to know about your kids' technology, look at the terrible technology we're making prisoners use. Because that's the way it goes.
I'm Charlie Meyerson, and on this edition of the Chicago Public Square podcast, Doctorow, visiting for the C2E2 Pop Culture Convention, talks about his collection of novellas, Radicalized, Four Tales of Our Present Moment. Before you hear how it sounded as we sat down at a kind of noisy Hilton Chicago, March 22nd, 2019, I want to lift the curtain a bit. This book made me break personal policy. As an interviewer of authors, I'm reluctant to read the book before the interview because I worry the interview then will go down the rabbit hole, interviewer and interviewee talking about things you haven't read and don't know about. I prefer to come to these encounters aligned with you, the listener, not having read the book. But as I set out to skim Radicalized, I got sucked in. I read it all, start to finish. I was, as they say, gripped. And not always in an enthusiastic, happy, upbeat kind of way. So I began by asking Doctorow how he feels about the future these days. Because to read the book is to worry he's been a little despondent lately.
Well, you know, these were kind of my Trump derangement syndrome therapeutic intervention. Like many people, the last couple of years have been really intense and not altogether pleasant. And I didn't write these having planned to write them. I wrote these, in fact, in the cracks between writing the Third Little Brother book, which I've just turned in. And I try to steer clear of making predictions about the future. I think science fiction writers, if anyone, should know that making predictions about the future is a mug's game. Not least because as an activist, I have to believe that the future is contestable. Like, what we do changes it, including doing things like writing stories. If the future were foreordained, I don't know why we'd ever get out of bed. And, you know, here in Chicago, there's a wonderful science fiction writer and scholar and historian named Ada Palmer, who teaches at the University of Chicago. And we're colleagues. We did a lecture series this year at the university. And Ada has this remarkable exercise she does every year with her students where they LARP a reenactment that runs for weeks on end.
Let's back up. LARP is?
Live-action role-playing game. So they do this reenactment of the election of the Medici's Pope. And every student is assigned a role, and they spend weeks horse trading and stabbing each other in the back and so on. And at the end of it, two of the candidates in the final four are always the same, but two are always different. And the way that I think about this is that we are neither prisoners of history, nor do we have the full range of motion. That there are always a couple of people whom the great forces of history foreordain might be at the front of the pack, but there's always going to be a couple of wild cards whose outcomes are dependent on what we do. And the way that those people who were foreordained to be at the head of the pack got there is based on earlier people exercising agency as well. So rather than trying to be optimistic or pessimistic, I try to be hopeful. And hopeful is the idea that if you can espy even one step you can take in any direction that will materially improve your circumstances, that from that new vantage point, as you ascend a gradient towards a better future, you might find another perch that you can take a step towards. That rather than being able to foresee in a kind of novelistic way a plot from A to Z that takes us to a better world, that it's enough to have a rule of thumb, a heuristic, a gradient you can follow that takes you towards a better future.
So how does that play out as you're preparing a book like this?
Well, so this wasn't so much a prepared book as it was an accidental one. I didn't prepare it at all. You know, in thinking through the problems of these characters, the thing that I'm always trying to keep at the front of my mind is how is it that these people are navigating a world in which it's difficult to see a way that gets them clear of their problems? How much of the terrain can they perceive? And what steps can they take? And how might they be misled, right? Because that's where drama comes from as well.
Each story in this book, and there are four of them, lives up to the title, I'd say, in a different way. People that in many cases we're familiar with, except maybe for the one with a superhero in it, they get radicalized into doing things that put them at odds with what a lot of us might think of as everyday behavior. Did you conceive of these four as a package, or did they develop independently?
No, very much independently. And so, you know, the first one, Unauthorized Bread, my publisher and editor were willing to, and ready to buy and publish last September. I gave it to them in June, and they were like, let's publish it in September. We'll do it as a standalone novella. It'll be just a skinny little paperback. We'll pay you a stonking amount of money for it because it's very au courant, and we're just going to rush it into print. And while we were negotiating it, I finished the second one. And they said, we'll do this one in October. And then I was like, you know, I have two more on the drawing board now. And they're like, all right, we'll do it as a book. And so that's how it got pushed out to March.
Let's talk about Bread, because there are lots of twists and turns in this story.
Sure.
I'm reluctant to summarize it.
So, you know, we live in a world today where, as a matter of nonfiction, this old Bill Clinton-era law called the Digital Money and Copyright Act makes it a literal felony to bypass a lock that protects a copyrighted work, even if you're doing something perfectly lawful with it. And originally, that stopped you from deregionalizing your DVD player, but now it's being used by, like, GM to stop you from fixing your own car. And John Deere uses it to stop farmers from getting the agricultural telemetry that they generate by driving their own tractors around their fields.
Everybody's in the content business now.
Yes and no. Yes, I think it's fair to say that copyright law has been hijacked by every industry as a means of creating monopolistic rents. And, you know, this gets really dark really fast. So, you know, you may think, oh, it's equitable enough that Apple gets to decide what apps I can put on my phone. Although, you know, as a person who makes copyrighted works for a living, the idea that if I make a copyrighted work like a piece of software and you own a computer that can run it, and I want to sell it to you, you're not allowed to run it until Apple gives us their blessing and takes 30% of the clearing price, does not strike me as being in a creator's interest. But Johnson & Johnson, let me know if you want to stop while that's running.
No, they're vacuum cleaning here at the Hilton Hotel on South Michigan Avenue. That's right. This is real life in Chicago, folks.
Sure. Yeah. So Johnson & Johnson just got regulatory approval for an artificial pancreas. So this is an insulin pump, a continuous glucose monitor, a little machine learning stuff in between. And they obviously can't charge a premium for insulin itself. Banting and Best, the Canadians who discovered insulin, thought it was too important to patent. But they have devised a cartridge that if you refill it, won't be recognized as refilled unless they bless the new cartridge. And so they can take people with diabetes and treat their organs like inkjet printers and charge them a premium. And to make things even worse, security researchers who discover defects in these products face the same liability merely for warning you truthfully about flaws in products that you are entrusting your life with. Like Medtronic just had a 9.3 out of 10 a severity advisory from the Department of Homeland Security because their implanted defibrillators can be activated wirelessly to deliver lethal shocks. And if they had just configured that device in the right way, it could have been a felony for the security researcher to warn us about it. So who has to use this technology? Well, there's an adoption curve for terrible technology where we first visit it on the people who have the least power, and then we walk up a gradient towards people with more power. So first it's refugees, then regular immigrants, then prisoners, parolees, mental patients, students, blue-collar workers, gig economy workers, white-collar workers. Science fiction writers can't tell you about the future, but if you want to know a little about your future, at least technologically, look at the terrible technology we're making kids use. And if you want to know about your kids' technology, look at the terrible technology we're making prisoners use, because that's the way it goes. So I wrote a story about a refugee who wins something of a lottery. She ends up in subsidized housing in Boston on the wait list, and she gets in, and this is housing in a luxury building. And to get permission to build this building higher, the developer has agreed to put in some below market rent floors. And just like developers do today, these floors are serviced by a separate lobby called the Poor Door. That's a real thing. And developers today, you know, they put in separate freight elevators so that the rich people and the poor people don't have to see themselves in the elevator. This developer's got a better idea. His Internet of Things elevator just won't stop for a poor person if there's a rich person in it. And it continues into the interior of the apartment. Your toaster won't toast unauthorized bread, so you have to buy your bread at a high markup from a vendor-approved store that kicks back to the landlord. Same goes for the fridge, same goes for every other appliance in your place.
And in fairness to the landlord, that's how the landlord makes up some revenue that allows the landlord to offer...
Well, hang on a second.
I'm just quoting your book, man.
Hang on a second, though, because if you're the landlord and you're getting a permission variance that allows you to add five more stories to your luxury building, you pocket tens of millions of dollars out the gate, right? So presumably that's the subsidy, right? If we in our democratic process have put a cap on the number of stories that a neighborhood can have, and a variance is granted, and the quid pro quo for all of the millions the developer gets to reap for that variance is that they have to have some below market rent apartments, that's what they get.
This is, as all of these stories in the book are, so like what people I know, people you know, are dealing with in real life these days.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's not hard to project where that goes. So the companies that run these, being financial wizard, you know, hedge fundy masters of the universe, are too clever for their own good, and their financial engineering bankrupts the appliances. And the only thing worse than an appliance that treats you as its adversary is one that stops working altogether. And so this is what spurs them into learning how to jailbreak their appliances. And it becomes something of a mission. And the kids in the building, led by this woman, Salima, who's a Libyan refugee whose parents were killed in the crossing, she becomes their kind of Johnny Appleseed, their mentor. And they jailbreak the whole building, which is great until the companies come back out of bankruptcy. And now the telemetry that they use to detect cheaters puts them at risk of being detected, charged with a felony, and ultimately deported to the countries they fled in fear of their lives. So that's when the stakes go way, way up.
In the time since the book's publication alone, just a few days ago, as we speak, you know, is it my imagination, or has the news caught up with these stories that you've written months and, well, months ago?
I'm going to say neither, right? I think that it's a bit of confirmation bias in the sense that these stories are always percolating, right? I wrote this book, Little Brother, 13 years ago now, and it's still read as a piece of very contemporary kind of techno-thriller. It's taught at West Point in the Cyber Institute. It's taught in the Air Force Academy. It's read by book clubs at this by the security departments of companies like Uber and so on. And it's a 13-year-old book, and the way that it still remains au courant, if I can be, you know, immodest enough to say that.
And French enough.
And French enough. I'm Canadian, so...
Okay, you got a pass.
Yeah. 5 years of mandatory French, right? It's use it or lose it. So the thing that made this story last is that I assumed that the underlying theoretical framework of computer science would be relatively stable, which it has been since the time more or less of Alan Turing and John von Neumann, that computers would get more important to our lives, which they have since that time, and that we would continue spectacularly to fail to come to grips with it, and that we would make policy that demanded the equivalent of saying pi must equal 3 because anything else is a bit untidy. And that this would continue to have predictably terrible consequences. You know, as an example, recently, the former Prime Minister of Australia, they get a new one every 8 months or so because they have such terrible governance, Malcolm Turnbull was told that if he banned working cryptography, that there would be no way to keep it working for the good guys, right, to make sure that your pacemaker wasn't getting malicious updates and your bank secrets weren't being stolen, while still allowing the police to break cryptography and attack the bad guys, that the laws of mathematics didn't allow it. And he said, the laws of mathematics are very commendable, but I assure you that in Australia, the law of Australia is the law of Australia. Potentially the stupidest thing anyone's ever said while holding public office, and that's a heavy trophy to win. If you write stories in which we continue to treat technology as though its most salient feature was that it might be used to recruit jihadis or to watch TV the wrong way or to look at pornography, as opposed to treating it as though it were the nervous system of the 21st century that binds together every activity that we undertake, you will continue to write fiction that chimes with the social problems that we're undergoing.
One of the stories in Corey's books puts a superheroic character in the middle of a police brutality case, not unlike, sadly, some that Chicago, among other big cities, has endured. And this story has a Clark, it has a Lois, it has a Bruce. Did you just want to call the guy Superman?
I was okay calling him American Eagle. I mean, I think that it's... there is something arch and fun, actually, about refusing to call him Superman, and it gives you the narrative space to be a little off canon. You know, and my superhero has been in America fighting for truth, justice, and the American way for 150 years, which gave him enough time to have been around when the plight of African Americans was even more visibly and undeniably something that, if you cared about truth or justice or maybe not the American way back then, you should have had an obligation to do something about. I wrote that book after reading Matt Taibbi's masterful history of the murder of Eric Garner by the New York Police Department, a book called I Can't Breathe. And the cops in that story, they're a death squad. They literally wander the streets of New York wearing t-shirts that quote Hemingway, talking about what a glory it is to hunt humans. And all the while they're racking up these giant settlements against the city of New York for human rights abuses, and no one puts two and two together and stops them, nor do they after Eric Garner is killed. They never faced any meaningful consequences. And in my story, Superman, something snaps. He's flying over Staten Island. He sees these cops administering one of their frequent beatings in the neighborhoods, quote, south of the Mason-Dixon line, the freeway that separates the predominantly African-American neighborhood in Staten Island. And he intervenes. And he intervenes because he thinks that after 150 years, his whiteness and his humanity are fixed, that no one will call those into question, that those are permanent conditions. And what he discovers is that the last one in the white privilege boat is the first one out, and that the moment that he throws his lot in against white supremacy, he'll be pushed straight out of the boat. And immediately you have pundits on the radio saying, well, he's called the American Eagle. What would stop him from choosing to be the Iranian Eagle? What do we know about this person? How could we stop him if he decided to get in the way of more police officers just doing their duty? And, you know, it's a story about the limits of allyship and the hard choices of allyship and the fact that everyone who's woken up one day and said enough is enough, I'm going to be an ally and try and use my privilege, has to answer the question, why wasn't enough enough yesterday? Or the day before, or 5 years ago, and what did I get by delaying the breaking point till now? What advantage was conferred on me by my participation in the system? And the real hero of that story is not Superman. He doesn't solve any of the problems. The real hero of the story is the guy who gets beaten up. And Superman, you know, is stuck having these debates with Bruce Wayne, who is the military contractor who's supplying the city with its predictive policing gear that has the cops going in and beating up black people in Staten Island. And Bruce Wayne wants Clark to know what the realpolitik is of asserting both white privilege and allyship, and just how easy it can be to lose that. Because Bruce Wayne may be evil, but he's nobody's fool.
Over the years, you've just, in many cases, given away electronic copies of your work. How's that worked out for you?
I think it's been uniformly positive. Unfortunately, my publisher is not willing to go along with it for this book or the last one, but you know, I have other books coming where that will be the case, and it has been the case before, and it will be again. I remain as convinced as ever that if you don't want to pay for my books, it won't be hard for you to find a way to read a copy without paying for it. And that means that ultimately everyone who buys an electronic copy of my books does so voluntarily, right? We talk as though there's the universe of Creative Commons works that people choose to pay for or not, and the universe of works that nobody could read unless they pay for it. It's just not true. It hasn't been true since the early years of the internet. It gets less true with every year. Your grandchildren are going to sit around the table in 50 years and say, tell me again, Grandpa, about 2019 when it was really hard to copy things, because it's only going to get easier. If it gets harder to copy things, it will be because something terrible has happened to the world, right? That it would be like a side effect of total civilizational collapse. All other things being equal, copying will be easier. And everywhere I go, I hear from people, especially people from backgrounds where normally it would be hard for them to lay hands on the work, either people who live abroad or people who are poorer, who say that getting access to the work through this try it for free mechanism was the thing that introduced them to it, and that in the absence of that, they never would have got there. So, you know, two nights ago in New York, I had someone with a Croatian name, and I asked him, you know, are you Croatian? He said, well, yes, I am. And he said, you know, in Bratislava, we couldn't get English literature, and we had no money to get it anyway. Now I'm a high-paid programmer in New York City, but the reason I'm a fan of yours is because I got your book for free. The number of people who fail to buy my book today because they never heard of it is much larger than the number of people that would ever fail to buy the book because there was a free download somewhere on the internet. And I'm reasonably sure there is a free download somewhere on the internet of this book too, regardless of the policy that I set for it. And so for me, having a means by which people could get the books through me meant that there was a kind of control process, right? One in which we were in this together and not one in which they were getting something over me.
And that happens at your website in many cases, craphound.com. And this giveaway free policy of yours, are you absolutely convinced that it has made you a more successful professional, however you define successful?
Sure, yeah. And it's also been a profoundly important moral force, I think. Copyright, for a whole variety of reasons, has become the dominant form of regulation over the internet, despite the fact that the internet is only incidentally an entertainment medium. And we, at times, regulate the internet only by attending to the impact on media companies, secondarily artists, but primarily media companies, even when those regulations have these effects that knock on other people. So we talked about the criminalizing of jailbreaking and how that affects people's security and prosperity. But you know, in the European Union on Tuesday, on March the 27th, they are going to vote on the new copyright directive and whether to include a rule that would say that if you operate a platform where people can make material available, type a message, upload a picture, upload a video, upload code or a Minecraft skin or anything else that might be copyrighted, you will have to operate a copyright filter that scans everything against a database that anyone can add anything to and lay claim to it as their copyright with no checks or balances to ensure that it really is. And if that filter in its sole judgment thinks that you're infringing a copyright, you can't make your material available. Now, the censorship possibilities are incredible. But beyond that, you know, just the possibilities for accidental suppression of speech, to say nothing of competition, because Google's version of this filter that works on YouTube and only does YouTube videos cost $100 million so far. Those impacts are enormous. And rights holders are cheering this on. You know, Debbie Harry of Blondie had an op-ed in The Guardian this week saying, I can't believe people are coming out against this. Don't they know how hard I work? Yeah, and I know how hard Debbie Harry works. I've seen her live. She is amazing. Doesn't she know how important the internet is to everybody else? It is astounding to me that people who are on the side of the arts and free expression, the minute free expression rubs up against an optimal outcome for them, free expression is jettisoned. I mean, I know they love the First Amendment. I just wish they'd share.
You've been to Chicago a few times.
Many, many.
What do you love and what disappoints you?
Oh, what do I love and what disappoints me? I love second cities, right? I grew up in Toronto, which like has a similar relationship to New York that Chicago has. You know, there's an old joke, how many Torontonians take to change a light bulb? Two, one to change the bulb and one to go to New York and make sure light bulbs are still cool. Second cities, you know, they have the cosmopolitan advantage of the big city, but at a much lower price, which means that you get a lot more weirdness, right? It's a lot more authentic. You don't have high streets that are just like some recycled background out of the Flintstones where it's the same 10 stores over and over again. Of course, second cities are becoming first cities, and this is a problem in Chicago and Toronto as well, not least because we're having real estate bubbles in these cities. What disappoints me about Chicago? Chicago's racial politics, I think, is probably the most, you know, obviously disappointing thing about this city, right? You know, the fact that you still can't get into the predominantly African-American neighborhoods through the highway or the public transit system readily because they were redlined off during the urban planning, that is an historically disgusting thing. But, you know, if you really want to dig into it, the fact that the Chicago PD were operating a torture black site, off-the-books torture black site, and there still hasn't been a meaningful reckoning for that. You know, an onshore Guantanamo within a city known as a progressive haven should be a stain on the conscience of everyone who knew about it, and its continued impunity should be a stain on the conscience of everyone who knows about it today and lives here and can do something about it.
What are your biggest concerns for society, for humanity on the planet Earth or in the United States of America?
Sure.
Or North America? And to come back to your stories, how do they reflect those concerns?
Yeah. Well, I think that we're in the grips of two related problems. One is that a lot of our issues are the kind of highly technical issues where cause and effect are separated by a lot of time and space. And so it's very hard to make definitive statements about these causal relationships until the problem is well advanced. Think of smoking and cancer, right? If the first time you took a cigarette puff, you got a tumor, then just no one would ever smoke, right? It's only the distance between the action and the effect that causes us to do it. Climate is another obvious example of this, right? And then, you know, so is bad technology policy, privacy policy, and so on. And the other thing that complexifies this is that we are living in a highly oligarchic moment in which we have a very unequal distribution of wealth. The number of firms that dominate each industry is dwindling. You know, this week we went from 5 movie studios to 4 as Disney was allowed to buy Fox. And the influence that they exercise has become so outsized that it's almost impossible to promulgate good evidence-based theory if it gores a rich person's ox. And rich people have a lot more oxes than they used to, so it's very hard to have any policy that doesn't gore a rich person's ox. So we're living in a moment of incoherence, and that incoherence makes it harder for us to differentiate different claims about what problems are going on and where they are. So think about the anti-vax movement. Right. The anti-vax movement starts from 2 absolutely ironclad true premises. 1, pharma gets away with murder. Right. The Sacklers are currently still among the great and the good, despite having deliberately created and promulgated the opioid epidemic that killed more people than the Vietnam War. And the second part is that regulators are totally captured and let them do it. And when a regulator tells you that a firm is in good standing, you don't have any good reason to believe them. That's also clearly true. And so then they proceed from there to say, pharma tells me that we need to buy their vaccines, and the regulator tells me that they're safe. Why should I believe them? And that epistemological incoherence, where the heuristics that we used to use, the rules of thumb that we used to figure out how we could adjudicate claims of truth about complex subjects that we ourselves did not have the expertise to evaluate, that has created a moment of crisis that makes it much harder for us to get to the point of what I call peak indifference, which is the moment at which people stop being indifferent to these problems that are off in the future and start taking on board the cause of changing them, or at least the acknowledgement that they're real. Because the thing that happens when peak indifference comes too late is nihilism, right? So we're in this fight between peak indifference and the point of no return, where if you get to the point where you finally acknowledge that there's a problem with, say, rhino populations, but there's only one of them left, you might as well find out what he tastes like. Right? So this race between nihilism and denialism, peak indifference and the point of no return, this is this race that we're in, and it is the result of epistemological incoherence that is the result of wicked technological problems and increased inequality that has been on the rise since the Reagan years.
One of the many, many hats you wear is co-editor of the blog boingboing.net, which claims to be a directory of mostly wonderful things. Mm-hmm. What gives you wonder? What gives you hope these days?
You know, we are in a moment in which people are really challenging a lot of the both the complacency and the nihilism. They're saying change is possible. In fact, they're saying change is possible at a rate that outstrips our so-called leaders. You know, there was a great editorial a couple of weeks ago saying, stop describing Americans as polarized, right? We're not polarized. 87% of us want net neutrality. The majority of us want Medicare for all. The majority of us want teachers to be paid a living wage. The majority of us want a $15 minimum wage. The majority of us think that immigration is a net positive, right? There is a tiny minority within, and mostly they're in the Washington consensus, supported by a base that operates in gerrymandered, anti-democratic, anti-majoritarian framework, who are pushing policies that are extremely unpopular. And, you know, I read, to kind of bring this back to science fiction, I read China Mayville, this wonderful fantasy and science fiction writer. He wrote took a break and wrote a piece of historical nonfiction, but in novelistic form, this history of the Russian Revolution called October. And he describes these two remarkable things that happened in the lead up to the revolution. The first was this sense that the Tsar was at the peak of his power, because every time there was any kind of challenge to Tsarist power, the response would be so violent and so all out that people would go, oh my God, the Tsar will tolerate no dissent. He must be at the top of his power if he's that unwilling to contemplate it. And the other is that as the Tsar's power was being revealed for being a fragile thing, as his overreaction was being revealed as the act of a desperate man at the end of his power, the so-called leaders of the revolution were accepting compromises that the people wouldn't accept. So, you know, the Tsar would say to the revolutionary leaders, well, we'll allow you to convene an advisory parliament, a Duma. You can give me advice. I won't take it, but you can give it. Right? And they'd say, well, that seems like a step in the right direction. We should be happy there. And the Duma would sit to meet, and the people would march off the streets, and they would surround the Duma, and they'd shout down their so-called leaders and say, all power to the people, all power to the Soviets, right? Get back out there and tell the Tsar that that rights are not given, they're taken, right? So we seem to be living in that moment right now. We think of the, you know, billionaire elite as being all powerful because of this, the kind of bedwetting authoritarian terror in the face of any kind of challenge to its power. But maybe it's the fragility that drives them to be so uncompromising, not their strength. You know, certainly we seem to be ahead of our so-called leaders on every metric. You know, in these stories, I try to dig into what that looks like when you get to the end of it. So there's the last story here is called the Mask of the Red Death. You know, it takes its title from this Poe story. And it's about the idea that in the face of policy that it runs contrary to both the will of the people and evidence, that you will eventually reach a breaking point. And that rich people kind of know this in their bones. And it's a story told from the point of view of a despicable Ayn Rand fanfic obsessed hedge fund millionaire whose takes as his starting premise that some people are just better than others. And the way you can tell is if they get rich, they're better, because the market's function is to pluck the worthy out of the crowd and elevate them to the point where they can make decisions for the rest of us. And he recognizes that automation is making the rest of us less important to the fortunes of people like him, and that someday we'll just all have to be liquidated one way or another. And he also recognizes that if he were one of those people, he wouldn't go gentle, and that he would, by the time he figured this out, he'd go out and find all the things you needed to build a guillotine on the lawn of someone like him. And so he's ready. When the day comes, he's built a bunker, he's going to go hide in it, he's got a lot of guns, he's got a lot of antibiotics, he's got a lot of, Bitcoin on thumb drives and gemstone quality precious stones and friends who know how to shoot, and he figures that eventually the poor people will all eat each other, and they can emerge like some kind of demented Frazetta painting and create a kind of warlord paradise for himself with a harem and all the riches he needs and so on. And what he's failed to appreciate is that, like it or not, we have a shared destiny. That destiny starts with our microbes and works its way all the way up to everything else, right? But the microbes are important, because if you think that the way that we get to a world in which the so-called useless people are dispensed with is by having 3 or 4 billion of us die, then you're going to have an awfully large pile of bodies lying around. And that is a public health hazard. And if we have a genuine crisis like that, the heroes of the crisis will not be the people who are hiding in bunkers wetting their beds. It's going to be the people who are down in the sewers getting the sanitation system running again. Because it doesn't matter how many guns you have, you can't shoot germs.
And in some ways, that's the happiest ending of all these stories in Radicalized.
Yeah, not for him.
Not for him.
Spoiler, but but for the rest of us.
I didn't give too much away.
Yeah.
Before we sign off, a few questions suggested on behalf of Chicago Public Square readers.
Okay.
You've written a number of books for young readers. Uh-huh. Does the prospect of them encountering some of your darker, more adult writing ever give you pause?
A little bit. You know, sometimes if I'm signing a book for a parent and a kid, and it's an adult book like Makers, which has, you know, some pretty serious bathing suit area material in it, I will say, and it's always awkward, like, to the kid and the grown-up, like, look, I don't want to talk over your head here, but I'm a parent too. There's a lot of post-pubescent material in this book, and if I were a parent of a kid your age, I would want to evaluate it to make sure I thought my kid was ready for it. That is your call to make, parent, kid, but I don't want you to be surprised.
You'll sign it anyway?
And of course, anything to make a book non-returnable.
Which of your works would you recommend new readers begin with?
Well, I'm always happy with the latest one. So, yeah, you can start with Radicalized.
Which of your books do you consider most visionary?
I don't like the term visionary.
So none of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think Little Brother, well, you know, so all of them dig into this kind of predicting the present business of just like pointing out the policy failings we're having now and just assuming they won't get any better. So, you know, Makers, Bree Pettis says that Makers are what inspired him to go and start MakerBot. So, you know, it had action in the world. Ed Snowden took a copy of the sequel to Little Brother with him when he fled, you know, Hawaii, went to Hong Kong and then to Russia. So that had some impact in the world, presumably. So, you know, they've all acted in the world. I'm much more interested in shaping the future than predicting it.
Whatever happened to Open Cola?
Yeah, so I did a startup called Open Cola back in the dot-com days in the late 90s, early 2000s. The company got liquidated by our dickhead investors and sold for tax credits to a company called OpenText that I think is still around. The recipe for Open Cola, which we did as a marketing stunt, is still around and people are making it.
So this is, the idea was?
It's an open source cola, yeah. Free as in cola. So there's this old joke that free software is free as in beer, or free as in speech, not necessarily free as in beer. And this was free as in speech and free as in cola.
So it's a recipe for making your own.
My dear friend Amanda Fobister developed the recipe for us. She's still around. She's a con runner. She ran a World Fantasy Con a couple of years ago. You can make it.
When's the last time you had some?
Oh, I don't drink sugary drinks.
What can't you live without?
I try not to be dependent on anything except the people I love. But practically speaking, you know, connectivity, a computer, a phone.
Your favorite character in all of your books, and why?
You know, I don't know that I have one. I suck at favorites, right? I've written 50,000 blog posts. If I was capable of having favorites, I might have stopped at 10, you know? I always am afraid that, like, people who have just, like, one book or one character that they, like, really relate to, it always ends up being, like, Mein Kampf, you know? It's all well and good to read one book, but then you need to read another one.
You can find Cory Doctorow probing the frontiers of our present and maybe our future at boingboing.net. And you can follow his books and download some of them for free at craphound.com. More Chicago Public Square podcasts through your favorite podcast player, in Spotify, on Amazon's Alexa-powered speakers, and on iTunes. Say, "Hey Siri, play Chicago Public Square podcasts." And if you enjoyed this and want more, and if you've listened all the way to the end of this podcast, you are just the kind of person whose support keeps these shows coming. Visit support.chicagopublicsquare.com. That's support.chicagopublicsquare.com. Chip in a few bucks, and maybe next time we'll be able to book a room without a vacuum cleaner. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for listening.